Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated on the 7th of July, 2021. The killing plunged the country into political, humanitarian, and security chaos. In the absence of a functioning government, and with a limited police force, rival gangs have increasingly seized control of most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and more than half of the country. There is not a single elected official left in office, and Haitians have been left with limited access to fuel, water, and food. But while the depth of this crisis is unprecedented, the influence of armed gangs and their relationship with politicians have a long history. So how did armed gangs become embedded in Haitian politics?
Welcome to Global Take, America's number one podcast, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign policy. This is Alexandria Haidar, your podcast host. Today we'll discuss the Biden administration's record on immigration with a focus on Haiti and touch upon U.S. policies impacting Blacks in Latin America, the 2021 Haitian migrant crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border stirred a lot of emotions and for many became a reminder of the unequal treatment of Black migrants by the United States government. How are Biden policies being received by those advocates promoting fair treatment of migrants from Haiti and other African nations? We explore this topic and more on Global Take.
So immigration is a huge issue for the Biden administration, especially domestically, because he is getting hit by Republicans in particular on his immigration policies. But he's also being criticized by Democrats and people who are supporters, immigration activists, because he continued with some of the policies from the Trump administration.
Jacqueline Charles, she has reported on Haiti and the English-speaking Caribbean for the Miami Herald for over a decade, a Pulitzer Prize finalist for her coverage of the 2010 Haiti earthquake. She was awarded a 2018 Maria Moores Cabot Prize. Let's listen to her take on U.S. policy and its impact in Haiti.
Specifically, Title 42, which was a pandemic era public health policy that allowed the United States to quickly expel asylum seekers who appeared, at the U.S. southern border with Mexico. So they were, either quickly expelled back to Mexico or to their home countries. Title 42 will go away on May 11th. Everyone is waiting to see what's going to happen. I think there's an expectation that there's going to be a surge at the border. And what we've been seeing from the Biden administration in the last couple of months is that a series of rollouts that they have introduced, for instance, a humanitarian parole program that we can discuss later for nationals of Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, which would allow them to basically migrate to the United States for a two-year humanitarian parole, mm-hmm. If they have a financial sponsor and if they qualify. And the big thing about that, as well as what we're seeing, is that instead of you just being able to come up to the border and say, hey, I have a problem and I want to apply for political asylum in the U.S., they basically have to go on an app now. So you have to be pre-authorized. And so if you're not pre-authorized, again, you risk being, being returned. So that's sort of the larger big picture. But for, Haitian migrants and migrants from other African countries, 2021 at the U.S.-Mexico border with Del Rio. Everyone saw the image of the Customs and Border Protection officer on the horseback.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection releasing a report today criticizing how Haitian migrants were treated on the Texas border last year. Many people found these images of agents on horseback trying to keep the migrants out troubling. Four agents will soon face discipline because of their actions. Political reporter Marcelino Benito has been taking a close look at that report. Marcelino?
Well, and the report is 511 pages long. It details what happened back on September 19th, 2021. Investigators found U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback used unnecessary force, but did not strike any migrants with their reins. We're learning what occurred that day, prompted by DPS orders that CBP says should have never been followed.
there is no justification for the actions of some of our personnel, including unprofessional and deeply offensive conduct.
CBP Commissioner Chris Magnus breaking down findings into controversial actions taken by Border Patrol agents last September as the agency worked to control an influx of 15,000 Haitians under the Del Rio International Bridge. These images of agents on horseback went viral around the world, President Biden condemning what he saw last year.
It's beyond an embarrassment. It's dangerous. It's wrong. It sends the wrong message around the world.
Something which some people, for them, it was a reminder. They thought it was a whip, or that it was, you know, from the horse, whatever. That image was just a very powerful and searing image in people's minds. And of course, there was a report that was done that basically did not find that it was a whip or anything, but acknowledged that we need to do some sensitivity training here. But for activists who have been fighting on this issue of Haitian migration for decades, yes, it was a reminder of how Haitian migrants have always been subjected to sort of this unequal treatment, you know, under the law, while other migrants, particularly in Miami, Cubans, for instance, when they were allowed to come in under wet foot, dry foot policy, meaning if they stepped foot on American soil, then they were allowed to remain. But if they were caught at sea, they were returned. Haitians, it was an automatic, we need to send you back. Today, we have seen a number of boats that have come in terms of we've been in the largest Haitian migration wave. We've seen a little bit of a slowdown on that, probably because of this humanitarian program, probably because there's a fuel crisis in Haiti and these trips are very expensive. But when they have arrived, one of the questions that advocates have been asking and really haven't been able to get answers is what's happened to these people? Are they being sent to detention centers and then being paroled on their own recognizance, or are they being quietly returned to Haiti, you know, once the cameras go away? And so that's a question that we've been trying to figure out, you know, in order to see whether or not they are being given the same kind of opportunities to apply for asylum as others, or are they not being given the opportunity to apply for, you know, for asylum? So I would say, at least for the Haitian community and for advocates who've been very vocal on Haitian migration, the Biden administration is really being received with a mixed bag right now. One, because of the continuation of Trump-era policies. Two, despite the fact that they have introduced something like a humanitarian parole program, which has, you know, divided Haitians. There's divided, you know, opinions on this. The reality is that in Haiti, Haitians are still having a difficult time qualifying, much less getting an appointment at the U.S. Embassy for a visitor's visa. They are being refused. You know, anecdotally, I'm just hearing a lot of reports. The U.S. doesn't share this information, but based on the anecdotes that we're hearing, it seems like it's a very high refusal rate, you know, with the current crisis in Haiti. At the same time, there are programs like the family reunification, which the Biden administration had announced last year during a summit, and that really is not up and running yet. And this is a program that basically, if I'm, you know, if my husband is in Haiti and I'm a U.S. citizen or you know, LPR, permanent resident, and I apply for him to come and join me in the United States. The idea was that they would basically allow that process to be sped up, similar to what they do for Cubans, Cuban Americans. But, you know, Trump tried to do away with that program. Biden basically reversed that decision, but we're not seeing it working. At the same time, this H-2A, H-2B, temporary worker visa program for agricultural workers and others. And I've basically been spending the last 2 weeks trying to figure out what in the world is going on with that program. And is anybody really taking advantage of it from, you know, from Haiti? And I keep running against roadblock, and more it's looking like not even that program is really working. So yes, I think that, you know, we're going to be in a presidential election in about, 2 years? We'll start to see that really drum up probably by the end of this year, next year. And I think that immigration is going to be this administration's Achilles heel, you know, those who are on both sides of the issue.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I guess my concern is just, even like just the process, like having the applicants apply on the app, like how realistic is that? I mean, if your country's broken down, there's sure the internet situation is dire, like that whole process is discriminating within itself, if you will.
Well, this has been heavily criticized by advocates for a number of issues. For one, you know, they call it a quote unquote wealth test. And in order for you to have a phone, you need to have funds to have a phone. And then you need to have even more funds to have a phone that's a smartphone. And then you need to be in a position where you have access to an internet. And then you also have to have some level of education in order for you to be able to read and to understand. Initially, when the app came out, it wasn't even in Haitian Creole. That's number one. Number two, there have been, you know, reports on the app having problems, you know, with the facial recognition and picking up dark toned skins, complexion. This is a technology that's used in airports. I've had that happen to me where I go and I try to, you know, I'm supposed to stand there and they're supposed to like capture my image and it doesn't capture my image because I'm on the darker side. Mm-hmm. When I've brought this up to people at DHS, they've sort of like reject this notion that some people are being discriminated against, but not really addressing the issue about this app, which again, lawyers have specifically gone on record and they've written to the Department of Homeland Security and raised this concern. And yeah, so it's this whole idea of taking people and sort of quote unquote hiding them online, because now the idea is that you don't see them lined up at the border trying to get in, but you basically, you know, they're somewhere out there on the internet ether. And again, what you know, advocates and immigration lawyers are also saying is that you're asking people to wait where you are. Well, what if where they are, it's not a safe space? You know, what if they are in a country that is not, you know, receptive to their nationality or to just refugees or asylum seekers in general? You know, so if you take your chance and you come to the U.S.-Mexico border, then you are at the mercy of an individual on the other side to have to decide that, yeah, you didn't feel safe. And I understand this was an emergency situation. That's why you came to the border without pre-authorization. So we're going to hear you out, or we're not, as opposed to we're going to, you know, ship you back to where you are. So this whole idea of the app, which I think they've announced that they're going to expand it, you know, even further. It has its pros and it has its cons. And definitely one of them is that in order to use it, you need to be able to read, you need to be able to have access to a phone, you need to be able to have access to the internet.
Well, I mean, we're focusing mostly on the migrants. We know why they're leaving, because of the political instability. I know with the U.S. government, they've historically supported ruthless leaders in Haiti. You know, why do we keep playing this game of politics with the Haitian people? Do you see any evolution in terms of U.S. policy towards Haiti?
Well, on the opinion side, I'll leave that to the experts because I don't have an opinion. I think that, you know, historically, when you've looked, you know, U.S. relations with Haiti has gone through very, you know, different ebbs and flows. You know, you saw, for instance, you know, one of the criticisms that you will hear from people, for instance, is that, you know, when Haiti was being supported by a dictator, was being ruled by the dictatorship, the Duvalier dictatorship, you know, he very much had the support of the United States. And we started to see the migration crisis. That's when, you know, Haitian migrants started to leave. But yet, you know, under U.S. policy, they were not seen as fleeing political persecution, human rights abuses. They were being considered to be economic refugees. And this has always been an issue, going back to your initial question about U.S. immigration policy. Well, Haitians are seen as economic, you know, refugees, as opposed to people who are fleeing a political or human rights abusive situation. And even today, when you talk to immigration lawyers, they will tell you that that is the hurdle that that Haitian asylum seekers have, that despite whatever has happened to them, whatever, you know, how much press something has gotten, that when you're in the eyes of immigration court, the first thought that they come is that, you know, you are trying to get to the U.S. because things are just so bad in Haiti, economically speaking. So today, what you see going on in this current context is that that you have, you know, groups of Haitians, civil society leaders, and others who are basically asking for a paradigm shift, a new relationship with the United States in terms of, you know, U.S. policy toward Haiti. What you're hearing from the U.S., they're saying that they want a Haitian-led solution. All of that is up for debate in terms of what is a Haitian-led solution, what does it look like, and what is a Haitian-led solution that the United States will actually, you know, will actually support. As far as, U.S. policy and why, you know, it continues to be the subject of criticism or dissatisfaction. I mean, that is something you will have to use U.S. policy individuals who are making those decisions and whether or not, do they learn from the past or what sort of debate reflection actually goes into the decision making when they decide that they are going to take this, they're going to take this route. But today, that criticism, though, is also the elephant in the room, because the debate before everybody is whether or not there needs to be some sort of outside intervention in Haiti to help the country address the overwhelming gang violence and kidnappings that are taking place. And so you have some people who say, this is a country that's always had, foreign boots on the ground and we don't need that. And other people are saying, no, we do need that. And I think what you're seeing from the administration is because of that division of opinion, because of the criticism that the United States has received, over decades about its interaction with Haiti, there's a lot of reluctancy there on the part of the U.S. to basically be the one to take this lead.
Oh, okay. I mean, speaking of that, I mean, you have other countries in the region, Jamaica, Dominican Republic, Cuba. Do you have any insight on what role they're playing in the United States
is the elephant in the room. I mean, it is the country. So, I think that has also, it's been a cure and a curse in the sense that other countries may want to step in, but they're basically looking to the U.S. and saying, well, if you don't want to take the lead, why should we take the lead? Cuba, has Cuban doctors in Haiti. They've always been there despite, the U.S. economic embargo with Cuba and those relationships. Haiti's always had its own relationship, with Cuba, but Cuba is not in the position to provide any assistance on this current crisis, security crisis. Jamaica recently stepped up and raised his hands and said, we're willing to participate in some sort of a multinational force, but this is not something that Jamaica can do on its own. Members of the Caribbean community met in the Bahamas in February. There was a lot of hope by some, both on the Haiti side and on the U.S. side, that they were going to take more of a lead role and maybe support a multinational force, but instead they pulled back on that and basically said, well, we're going to focus on, training the Haitian National Police. So they basically took the position that Canada took. So that's been the challenge, the challenge for the United States, which supported, Prime Minister Ariel Henry's request for a quick, rapid deployment of multinational force into Haiti, was that, okay, let's try to find some other way of achieving this other than going through the United Nations Security Council for peacekeepers. And so when they basically put the call out and saying, okay, are there any takers? What we have seen, more than 4 months later is no, that there haven't been any takers. And so as a result, last month, President Biden, while he was visiting Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in Canada, basically confirmed that they're going to have to go back through back to the Security Council and look at a deployment of peacekeepers. Now, if and when that will happen, that's anybody's guess, because the reality is you've got two countries named China and Russia that sit on the Security Council and they have a vote. And we all know about the dynamics in terms of U.S., Chinese, and Russian relationships. So, and unfortunately, Haiti is now being caught in the middle of this geopolitical issue that it has nothing to do with.
Okay. And then and speaking of that, these divergent views, you have Prime Minister Trudeau with his viewpoint, and then, of course, Biden, you know, what are some of the challenges when it comes to these divergent views and that each of these routes face, like supporting troops on the ground using UN peacekeepers versus like providing training for the national police in Haiti? What are some of
the Prime Minister Trudeau has very much focused on the idea of strengthening the police, which the U.S. is not opposed to. The United States has spent over $90 million last year in terms of security assistance in Haiti, and they're currently training a new Haitian SWAT. France is also providing training to Haitian police officers in combat anti-gang tactics. The issue is that those are a long term. That's not something that's immediate that you're going to see the effects of that. At the same time, you have a country of 12 million people. You have a police force, that was 9,000 active, ready to roll before the Biden administration announced this humanitarian parole program. What's been clear is that there have been a number of police officers that have left. And we're all trying to still figure out what that number is. I mean, it was to the degree that the demand from the police to be considered for this program was so high that the Director of Immigration actually set a separate office just for police officers to go and apply for their passports. So that's a reality. So how are you going to provide training and beef up a beleaguered police force in a country where the door has also been flung open for them to leave, and people are in need of immediate help? So that's where you have the diverging views, which is, you have Canada with the police training, which, it's needed in any circumstances, but are you going to have the immediate effects? And given the fact that there have been so many dozens of police officers who have been killed, in the last, year since 2021, since the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, that's a huge concern. We have police officers who have been abandoning their posts.
There have been more civilians killed in Haiti than Ukraine in the first months of 2023, according to the United Nations World Food Programme. Powerful gangs are battling overmatched police in the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. In the middle, the population. Exclandia Belizaire lives in Cité Soleil, an epicentre of the violence. Her stepfather was shot dead on her doorstep. Now,
in some of these rural communities because of the gang violence. And we already know that police officers in Haiti don't have, proper guns. If a gun at all, they don't have bulletproof vests. Don't get paid on time. They don't get a decent pay. So these are all challenges, that are affecting a force. And you're saying, go out and put your life on the line. And you have people saying, for what? For what? For whom? At the same time, the Prime Minister of Canada has focused very much on sanctions. So is the U.S., but the U.S. is nowhere near implementing the number of sanctions, that Canada has done. Yes, they have. The United States and Canada last year started to roll out sanctions against gang members, against people in the private sectors, against politicians, all in Haiti, who they accuse of basically fanning instability, of having ties with gangs or supporting, gangs. At the same time, the United Nations, for the first time in 5 years, approved a sanctions regime, and for the first time ever for this hemisphere, basically said that we're going to start slapping sanctions on individuals that we feel are a threat to the peace and stability of the region, of the country. And so you're seeing that's happened in Haiti, but the issue with the sanctions is that when you deal with one thing, do you end up creating another problem? And so if you take, for example, that since October, there have been a number of individuals who have been hit with these financial sanctions, which means that in the countries where they're getting hit, whether it's Canada, the United States, their assets are being frozen. They cannot travel to these countries. The banks in Haiti have reacted by basically calling them up and saying, listen, come pick up your check because we have to close your account. And people who are close to them who sign on to their accounts, they're also getting their accounts closed as well. So the sanctions and the fear of people getting sanctions means that today, people who may have been like providing funding to gangs so that they don't attack their businesses, so that they don't get kidnapped, these individuals are afraid and they're no longer giving that funding to the gangs. And so the gangs are not getting that kind of financial financial resource, but what are they doing to make it up? Because they still have a payroll to make. They still are, you know, their lifestyle has not changed. So what we have seen is a huge spike in kidnappings. Kidnappings for the first period of this year compared to last year have gone up 173%. And that's just confirmed kidnappings, because not every kidnapping is actually confirmed. And so, you know, every day you're getting reports, and it's multiple reports of people who have been grabbed. And these gangs are asking for high amounts of money, sometimes in the millions of US dollars. And so that's one of the negative effects or things that maybe people didn't think about that you're starting to see. So you have that, and then you have the idea of troops. And again, as I said, this is a very divisive issue for Haitians. It's you know, for those who think of this country as this is a sovereign country, why do we need foreign help? But for that, you know, but for that woman that had to basically deliver her rapist, you know, kid, how do you tell her that you should not have outside help? You know, people every day are living in the country in fear. They are vulnerable. This is no longer just only certain people get kidnapped. There are reports of people who are well-to-do with mansions, you know, in the mountains of Port-au-Prince. They're having to flee their homes because the gangs have taken over. You know, over 100,000 people have been internally displaced in this country. And at the same time, you know, gangs are using sexual violence as a tool. So women are being raped. You know, children are being raped. I mean, this is happening in front of them. We've seen a rise of cholera because you cannot even get fresh drinking water into some of these communities. I mean, it really is indeed almost beyond a humanitarian crisis that anybody can imagine.
Wow. We know that you are definitely in touch with this issue. I never, all of those, that is just so tragic just to hear all of that. In terms of like, what do the gangs want? Like, are they trying to gain political control over the country, or are they just trying to, you know, get funding from the rich of Haiti to, you know, support their criminal activity? Like, what is their end goal? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there are hundreds of gangs in Haiti. Some are more powerful than others. Some are more politically astute than others. When you hear some of them talk, they will tell you, you know, they sound like the average frustrated Haitian in that country, you know, where they're very critical about the governance or lack of governance that has taken place, the divide between the haves and the have-nots. And then at the same time, you know, you have, you know, gang members who basically want a rap career. And so you see them, you know, putting videos out on YouTube and other social media. But what they're rapping about is they're also rapping about, you know, their escapades and their alleged crimes. You know, this is not something about, you know, you're just going to go in and take out the gangs. I mean, I think we have to recognize that what you have is a group of individuals who probably have never seen a working, functioning democracy in their life, because this is still a very young country. More and more, when they think about the divisions and the lack thereof, it feels some sort of an anger. It you know, people are asking, is it going to feel some sort of a civil war, the haves versus the have-nots? When they are, you know, receiving these funds, we don't see much that is being shared in the communities, although I did hear about one particular, you know, group of gang members that were building a hospital in one of the communities that they were in. It's a very complex situation. And at the same time, you know, there are neighborhoods that you drive around the capital and you will see, or you talk to people, they'll tell you that they prefer this group versus that group, you know, because this gang doesn't do kidnapping or this gang doesn't do this. But when you have a country where there's an absence of the state, meaning that, you know, there's not a justice system to go if somebody has wronged you, there's not a police to turn to for protection, what happens? You have other groups that step into that void. And so in some of these communities, these gangs are judge and jury. You know, if you have a problem with your neighbor, they are the ones that are basically settling that squabble, you know. But again, nothing is off limits anymore. Children are being abducted out of their classrooms. kids aren't safe just because they go to schools. Doctors aren't safe because they save lives. I mean, when you see the list of people who are being grabbed or who are being killed, what you realize that there's no sacred cows. Just last week, someone was kidnapped while attending a Catholic mass. I mean, inside a church. We saw it
during the mass
years ago, but you know, now it's, you know, unfortunately, the abnormal is now increasingly becoming normal, the norm.
That is intense. I mean, when you look at the whole situation, the gangs, the political instability, the migration issues, historic policies and injustices towards Haiti by the United States government, what would it take at this point if you were to devise a policy to address all of these issues? Because it seems like all of them are interrelated.
Well, that's beyond my pay grade and beyond my scope. You know, again, I think that, you know, the crisis in Haiti is very complex. And let me just say, I mean, I think it's very easy for people to beat up on the United States. But I don't also think that it's fair. I think that everybody has, you know, has blame in this. And at the same time, you know, despite people's criticism of the U.S. or U.S. policies, they are still very much looking to the United States for that help. I mean, people are still getting on boats and trying to come to the United States. They're not trying to go to China or Russia. So I think we have to be honest with ourselves as well and be real about that. I think that, you know, you need to look at sort of the core of the issues. What are the issues that are eating this country up? And then whoever gets paid to do that needs to say, okay, here are the programs that we're going to do. Here are some of the things that we're going to try. But one of the things that needs to always be done is that Haitians need to be at the table. They need to have a seat at the table. It can no longer be where decisions are being taken for Haitians without a conversation, or it becomes an afterthought. You know, today, you know, these are the individuals who are in these communities, far-flung communities, that are having to cope with the fact that they cannot get potable water, they cannot get crops to grow, they cannot get enough to eat. So they're also facing a hunger crisis where almost, you know, half of this population, you know, can't find enough food to eat. So you need to, if you're going to try to find solutions, you need to talk to them. The average person who doesn't have a voice, who doesn't have an access to my microphone, you know, my notebooks, to basically say, here's what I need, or here's why I think that we need to go the road that we need to take, because there's no shortcuts in this. And when you look at Haiti, you look at the challenges, there needs to be short term, medium term, and long term. There's no silver bullet.
And like, I know, like, some world leaders, particularly Prime Minister Doe, argued for Haitian-led solutions. Like, how influential is the Haitian diaspora in U.S. Haitian policy? And who are the groups? Who are the main players?
There are a lot of groups, and I'm not going to name names because that always gets you in trouble. You know, you have a Haitian diaspora that has strived, right? I mean, in South Florida, we are celebrating, you know, 50 years of Haitian migration, meaning 50 years from the first documented boat of Haitian refugees. I mean, this is a community where, you know, we put the first Haitian in as mayor of any city, modern city in the United States, you know, in modern times. Philippe Duro was in El Portal. And then we came back with Joe Celestin and made him, you know, the mayor of North Miami, the first Haitian American to be mayor of a big city, of a large size city in the United States. And he was actually, you know, a Republican, a registered Republican. You've had Haitians in the state legislature. While some places today are starting to, you know, elect Haitian Americans there first, you know, Miami-Dade can say that they, you know, they were electing first for a very long time. And this is a community where it likely shouldn't have happened, because these were not the people who, you know, came to the United States on planes because they were educated in Europe or they had passports with visas. These are people who were basically farmers and living in rural, you know, communities in Haiti and fleeing the situation in that country and risk their lives at sea and basically have done good. They are concerned about the situation that's happening, you know, in Haiti. I think one of the problems that's happened in the United States is everybody's looking for everybody to be united. Haitians are not united on things. We, you know, they have very strong opinions. opinions, and their opinions differ. This is a country that's polarized. It's a country that's unequal. It's a country of different experiences. And I think also that the closer you are to what's happening in Haiti, meaning you have family members who are living this drama day in and day out, your perspective is very different from somebody who is also Haitian, but does not have that experience. They may be looking at it from a different viewpoint. And I think that that's the thing that people need to appreciate. So, you know, the person that's coming to the table and saying, you need to do this, you need to do that. Well, you need to take one step further and say, so where are you getting your information about what's going on? Are you getting it from the blogs, or are you getting it because you're getting the phone call from the family member who basically is telling you that they're hiding under their bed at night because, you know, all they're hearing is the chanting of bullets going off, you know, and it's coming closer and closer to their home and they don't know where to run or where to hide anymore.
Well, speaking of the head, kind of moving over towards Latin America, I know Brazil's new president, Lucio Inácio Lula da Silva, met with President Joe Biden in the White House in February, and the two hope to reset relations after white-wing populists were seen as threats to democracy in both countries. Can you just talk about the impact of the Brazil's version of January 6th, like those protests and them taking over the Capitol buildings in Brasilia, and its impact on Black Brazilians? I don't know if you could reflect on that.
Well, I think first we need to talk about January 6th here in this country. I think that when January 6th happened, while some people were very focused on the domestic, you know, issue and the domestic impact, I mean, for those of us who, you know, come from a global perspective and look at international politics, I mean, you know, immediately what we start saying is, wow, what's the message that we're sending to our international partners? What are we saying to people? And so that was really, you know, disconcerting and very worrisome. And then, of course, what happened is Lula wins and Bolsonaro doesn't. And then you see a version of January 6th, you know, play itself out there. I think that the reality is that today in Latin America, we're seeing a strong move in terms of what's happening, you know, in this region. A lot of people sort of questioning the United States' commitment and policy toward Latin America as a whole. There are a number of places that don't have ambassadors. There's a feeling that the U.S. isn't as engaging as it should be, as it needs to be. So as a result of that, you're seeing, you know, by virtue of these recent leaks that happened, more of a role of China and Russia, like literally moving into America's backyard. Although I know some people don't like that phrase, backyard. So that's moving closer to home.
Right.
And so I think so that's a reality that whoever is governing this country in the next, you know, 5 years, 10 years is gonna have to address. And you know, I particularly focus a lot on the Caribbean. And when I go to these meetings with, you know, Caribbean officials, there's always this complaint from them. The fact that they feel overlooked, disregarded, you know, by the United States, it's always the same, you know, concerns that they have. And then, you know, a bone gets thrown at them. But again, for instance, you know, CARICOM just finished up a meeting about, you know, gun violence and how it's an epidemic. You know, it's a pandemic, actually, that's happening, you know, in the region. But where are these guns coming from? They're coming from the United States. So they want to have more of our activism, and they want more acknowledgement on the part of the U.S., and they want the U.S. to assist them more in that. But in general, in Latin America, I think you have some of those same issues, whether it's about gun violence, whether it's about trafficking, you know, whether it's about democracy being under threat. There's concern that a lot of attention is not being paid to them. In the particular with Lula, you know, this is not his first rodeo. He has been president of Brazil in the past. I think there needs to be a lot of repairing done with his relationship with Washington. We've seen that they've not been able to see eye to eye, particularly on the war with Ukraine and Russia. The U.S. wanted his assistance in sending some arms to Ukraine, and Brazil is pushing back on that. There's been some people looking at Brazil and seeing, can they play a bigger role in Haiti, particularly in terms of some sort of a security assistance, given the fact that they have experience with gangs, they have experience with these ghettos, and they also led the United Nations peacekeeping force in Haiti. So they have a military that's familiar with that terrain. But I don't know if the relationships between Brazil and the U.S. is of the point right now where the U.S. can basically ask them to take that lead. I think there's a lot of unsettled business with Lula in the United States from the last time when he was president. I think for Black Brazilians in general, you know, what's interesting is that what Brazil has the largest number of Black people outside of Nigeria. And as much as we in this country, in the United States, you know, talk about issues of racial disparity and racism and discrimination, I mean, you still very much have that, you know, in Brazil. And I think that, you know, for Black Brazilians, I mean, they're going to be, first of all, they're going to be like everybody in Brazil, like looking at this president to say, okay, what are you going to do? What policies are you going to introduce to make life better, right? Because everybody's still coming out of this COVID pandemic, even though COVID still exists, but we're all still feeling the ramifications of that economically, humanitarian-wise, health-wise. And then particularly for Blacks, they want to feel that they're just equal footing, that there's opportunity for them to advance, you know, in this country, that there's an opportunity, a space to address the historical wrongs, a space to, okay, let's address the racism, but let's move past it. Let's figure out how do we get past it. So if Lula is indeed extending that olive branch to this large component of the population, they're going to also be looking to him to deliver, that it's no longer just about paying it lip service.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of delivery, I mean, if Latin America in some ways kind of is very definitely influenced with how they run their democracies based on what they see in the United States. And then you see what's happening in terms of the Biden administration delivering on police reform and the Voting Rights Act towards Black Americans. I mean, do you see any correlation between the urgency of Latin American governments addressing the needs of people of African descent in their country based on the region and the leadership in the region, I'll put it that way?
Look, I mean, every country is different and every country has its own dynamic and every country has to go at its own pace. And I think that we need to be careful in terms of don't compare, apples to oranges. I mean, I learned this when I went to Africa. It's like, okay, I'm Black, you're Black, but we have completely different experiences. And there's just, for instance, we have this idea in the United States that all Black people have to, you know, think alike and be on the same page. Whereas in Africa, it's like, no, we got 60 different tribes and we're very different, you know, even though all our shades might be the same. So I think that that's one of the things that you have to, as Blacks who are living in America have to consider in terms of Blacks who live elsewhere. I'm from the Caribbean. And one of the issues that always be like, where are you? You know, what are you? Where are you from? And I'm like, I'm Caribbean. No, you're Black. No, I'm Caribbean. You're Black. Like, I know I'm Black, but when I say to you I'm Caribbean, that takes on a whole different specific things. And with that comes a whole set of different sort of packages. You know, years ago at the Miami Herald, we did a project about race in Latin America, and particularly looking at how Blacks in Latin America are treated. And what we found is in different countries where we went to, there were different dynamics. And while there were these sort of general issues or feelings of racism, it took on different degrees and meant different things depending on the country where you went to. If you're an Afro-Colombian, you know, there's a level of pride that you have and comfort that you have, and you know, in Cumbia and your history, that and you have this ability to be visible that Blacks, say in Uruguay, do not have, you know, where they're there, but they're basically virtually invisible. I think when you look particularly at Brazil, that the reality with Brazil is that they have this very large Black population. And, you know, on paper, one may think that they may would have advanced further and done this and that. But no, I mean, Brazil has serious issues of racial discrimination. And even within the whole color scheme of Blackness, mm-hmm. So I think that first and foremost, it has to begin where you have to have that space to talk about those issues. And then on top of those issues, I think you have to figure out, okay, where are we going to go with that? And Brazil has is dealing with not just the Black Brazilians, but you also have this, you know, Haitian population that's, you know, that is also there. And so how does that fit in? Yes, we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, incidents of police brutality, but this is also a country that's dealing with an overwhelming number of crime. Not that it's justified the brutality, but there's an overwhelming number of crime. So I think that everybody just has to deal with this in their own space. And there's a recognition of, okay, how did we get here and where do we want to go?
And speaking of that, thank you so much. We really gotten a really thorough understanding of the Haitian migrant crisis, U.S. policy towards Haiti, and what's happening in Brazil and Latin America at large. So thank you so much for joining us on Global Take. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
And that does it for us on Global Take, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. If you enjoyed this episode, please like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. You can find us at Black Professionals and International Affairs at www.iabpia.org. You can also find all podcasts on Spotify as well as Apple Podcasts. So please like and leave a comment. Thank you.